KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on two guests, one of whom is the first three-peat that I have on the show. The authors are Dan Burke and Mark Lemley, and the book is the new book, The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. Hearsay Culture has spent quite a bit of time over, especially the last year to 18 months, discussing patent law issues. We've discussed patent law and patent law reform with people like Josh Lerner and Mike Moyer, and David K. Levine, again, no relation, and you can debate who took whose name, although David's name certainly is much more well-known than mine in the field of intellectual property and economics, so I guess I'll have to say I took his. But David K. Levine and Michele Boldrin were on recently. All of these authors have taken more or less a view of that does not necessarily support where we are today in intellectual property law, and specifically in patent law. And in Mark and Dan's book, they take a close look and a broad look at a lot of the empirical data that suggests that patent reform is necessary, and then reach a conclusion which on its surface may seem to some counterintuitive and perhaps not a solution at all. Because they say, and they make the argument very strongly in the book, that the courts are the best place to focus on patent reform. Patent law, it particularly in the last several years, has been a major focus of the courts generally. There have been several Supreme Court decisions in patent law, and in fact, today we're recording this interview on Monday, June 1st, and the Bilski case, perhaps the most prominent current patent law case, has been granted cert, and so we're going to discuss at the beginning of the show Dan and Mark's immediate reaction to that development that literally occurred today, Monday, June 1st. And then we're going to be getting into Mark and Dan's book. The Patent Crisis is a book that certainly requires knowledge of patent law, although I was impressed in reading the book that I think Dan and Mark do a good job contextualizing this topic for those that are not familiar with patent law by getting into some of the basics, and we're going to do that today on Hearsay Culture. We're then going to get into, after we discuss Bilski and its potential ramifications, get into the meat of the book and really go directly to the main conclusions and arguments that Dan and Mark make. By way of quoting the book, on page 5, they say, "We hope in short to convince the reader of three things. First, that a purely unitary patent system no longer fits the extraordinarily diverse needs of innovators in today's technology industries. Two, that the solution is not to split the patent system into industry-specific protection statutes, but to tailor the unitary patent rules on a case-by-case basis to the needs of different industries. And three, that is, and perhaps the most controversial point, I should put in parentheticals, that is the courts, not Congress or the Patent and Trademark Office, the PTO, that are best positioned to do this tailoring." In an hour-long interview, of course, we can not get into all of the details of these three points, but we're going to take a broad look at them and discuss them with Dan and Mark. By way of very brief introduction, Dan Burke is a Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, and Mark Lemley is the William H. Newcomb Professor of Law at Stanford University. And by way of disclosure on my end, I was a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School and currently a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, which is under the aegis of the Law, Science, and Technology group at Stanford, and Mark is the head of that. So, by way of disclosure, you could say, at one point, I was paid by Stanford University, I'm not anymore, and at one point, I answered to Mark, and now I merely look to him as a mentor, among many other things. So, there's my disclosure. Gentlemen, Dan and Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Happy to be here.
Let's jump right in. Normally we'd go right into the book and discuss it, but I think in light of today's developments, we should discuss Bilski for a few minutes. So, what's your reaction to today's development? What's your thought about where we're going with Bilski?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily significant. Of course, a lot is going to depend on what the Supreme Court does with the case, but the Supreme Court has taken a lot of important patent cases over the last several years. I think this has the potential to be the most important. The Bilski case in the Federal Circuit en banc was really a watershed. We're still trying to sort out the implications, but I think that that Federal Federal Circuit decision has been extraordinarily problematic. What the Supreme Court will do is anybody's guess. They have not in the past been particularly supportive of software patentability, but they've also not considered the issue for 28 years. And the decision, I think, is going to be one that really does hold in the balance the fate of hundreds of thousands of patents.
So, David, as you know, the Bilski case is a case that raises a lot of issues that are on people's minds. How far should the patent subject matter range extend? You know, should it extend to software, as Mark's just talked about? Should it extend to business method patents? Should it extend to diagnostic processes? And the Supreme Court has indicated previously some interest in this area. They took a case and then decided they had taken it improvidently and dismissed it, dealing with a patent that covered a method of diagnosis, of testing for a particular substance in the blood and then the doctor diagnosing a disease. They decided that was the wrong case. Justice Breyer said he really thought it was an important area when that was dismissed and showed a lot of interest in it. So obviously they feel like they found the right case now to begin addressing that question. And as Mark said, the lower court decision in the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit left us with a lot of questions. As you know, patent law is kind of special in the United States. Other kinds of federal cases, whether they're criminal cases or copyright cases, would originate in a district court in some part of the country and then would be appealed to a geographic circuit court. You know, so the cases from California go to the Ninth Circuit, and the cases from New York go to the Second Circuit. Well, that's not true for patent law. All the patent cases from around the country go to one central court in Washington, D.C., this court we're talking about, the Federal Circuit. They've given us a decision that a lot of people thought was not very helpful as to what the extent of patent subject matter ought to be. And the Supreme Court's been waiting for the right case to think about this, and they've apparently decided that this is the case to do it.
Are either of you surprised that the court is going this direction? In other words, was there any thought that Bilski had ended?
Well, so I'm a little surprised. You know, I think the real reason for that is I think there's probably close to unanimous consensus that Bilski's particular application shouldn't be patented. And the Supreme Court always says it reviews decisions, that is, results, rather than opinions. And in this particular case, there's essentially no reason to have taken the case except to review and clarify the Federal Circuit's opinion on the legal standards for patentable subject matter. So I don't expect that Bilski's going to get a patent at the end of the day, but this does, I think, serve as some indication that the court is both interested in the issue and perhaps thinks that the Federal Circuit's test created in Bilski is problematic.
I think that's right, and you know, the Supreme Court kind of watches how things develop, and it's very clear that this issue is coming to a head, that it's really on people's minds. You know, we said we've had some past indications that at least some justices on the Supreme Court really wanted to address this issue. We've seen in the past couple of weeks the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, file a lawsuit trying to get at the same question. If you have been watching the news, you know that they filed a lawsuit challenging some genetic diagnostic patents, challenging whether DNA sequences should be patentable. So that's that same patentable subject matter question again. And in fact, the ACLU filed an amicus brief in the lower court Bilski case before the Federal Circuit, and they said that they were very concerned that patentable subject matter was beginning to extend to things that implicated civil rights, things like patents on methods of advertising, you know, that has clearly First Amendment free speech issues, or patents on methods of plotting a novel. Again, that has speech issues. Some patents even have racial or other kinds of civil rights issues. There's been a lot of publicity about this. Groups that you wouldn't have expected, like the ACLU, are starting to get involved. I think the Supreme Court's sensitive to that, and they saw a chance to address this, and this seems to be the case where they want to do it.
I certainly look forward to seeing what the court does in Bilski, and this is probably the earliest time I've ever done this on the show to invite gentlemen you back on the show to discuss Bilski once we have a decision. And it's going to be a case obviously that's watched very closely by you and by anyone that's interested in patent law. You know, Dan, you mentioned right up front the breadth of patents and what can be patented, and I think it's a nice way to begin our discussion of your book, The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. You already just right there mentioned items that, at least at first blush, do not seem like the kinds of items that should be patented or that patent law is designed to cover. We'll get into that a bit, but for those people that are not familiar with what a patent is, what is your 1 minute overview of what a patent is?
A patent is a grant of exclusive rights from the government. It's a right to exclude other people from making, using, or selling a particular invention that's described in a document that we call a patent. In order to get that set of rights, you have to file an application before a federal agency that you mentioned a moment ago, the United States Patent and Trademark Office. They look at that application. They decide if it meets the statutory criteria for receiving this set of exclusive rights, and after a dialogue back and forth with the inventor or the inventor's attorney, they issue this document that we call a patent, and those rights are then granted to enforce that patent in federal court. And the patent is supposed to describe to the public how to make and use the invention. You can't do that without permission of the patent owner until the patent expires, which is usually a little under 20 years. You get 20 years from the date that you file the patent application. There are different theories as to why we have patents, but the dominant one seems to be that we want to give people a chance to recover the money they've invested to create new inventions. We want to create incentives for innovation, and so we give people these governmental exclusive rights to do that.
The gentleman, I'll open this up to either of you that want to take it. Dan, when you mentioned something like a patent on advertising methods, the first thing that jumps into my mind is, wait a minute, aren't those things that are copyrightable, potentially trademarked, even perhaps, thinking more broadly, they might in some ways, or at least some portion of information, might even be a trade secret. How is, Mark, perhaps you could take this or either of you, how does patent law overlap with copyright and trademark in ways that, again, focusing on your book, could lead to some problems with the law?
Well, so the answer is we don't require you to elect one particular type of intellectual property protection. There was an old doctrine that said you got to choose one, but we threw that out several decades ago. And I think we did that for good reason. Inventions today are complex. They're often multi-component technologies. And it may well be the case that copyright is better suited to protect certain aspects of an invention, say a computer program, but patents or trade secrets are better suited to protect other aspects of that program. And so what we have now is a world in which different types of intellectual property coexist, sometimes in the same invention, either at different times or because they protect different aspects of that invention. I don't think that is itself problematic, but it does mean that when you think about the need for the incentives Dan talked about, those incentives are going to be differently important in different industries. If I get copyright protection for my computer program that prevents piracy of that program, that fact is of significance in deciding how important patent protection for the same program is. If I get trademark protection for my advertising method, or if I get trade secret protection for my new financial innovation, those additional forms of protection can substitute for and therefore make less necessary patent protection for some of those inventions.
And I think an important part of what Mark is saying is, you know, that traditionally we thought that patents were really about machines and functional utilitarian kinds of things. Copyright was really about literary and artistic works. You know, the patent statute says that patents can be granted for machines and compositions of matter and articles of manufacture and processes. Copyright statute talks about literary works and pictorial, graphic, and sculptural works. But in the information age, as Mark says, where we have these very complex devices, very complex innovations, where information is really at issue, it's increasingly difficult to tell, gosh, is this something that is sort of textual and that belongs to copyright, or is this something more utilitarian that we think belongs to patent law? And so more and more we see these different forms of intellectual property coexisting alongside each other in an overall business scheme for managing new innovations.
We're talking with Dan Burke and Mark Lemley, authors of the book The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. The first point that you articulate as your goal for the book is to convince the reader, as I mentioned, that we do not have a purely unitary patent system. Now, a logical question as I was reading the book was, what is the patent system? But based upon your conclusion, I think I want to ask the question differently. In light of the fact that you argue that we do not have a unitary patent system, what system do we have today, and is it fair to even call it a system?
Well, so the answer is we have a patent system that is nominally unitary. Right, there is one patent office. You get a patent. It has a single term for the most part. But the patent system functions differently in different industries. People use patents for different things in different industries. It's easier in some industries to get patents than in others. And in part, that's a reflection of the fact that innovation works very differently in different industries. The innovation process and the role patents play in that innovation process in the pharmaceutical industry are different from the role of patents in the computer software or the telecommunications industry to such an extent that the two are almost unrecognizable. If you took a pharmaceutical patent lawyer, a litigator who was used to dealing with the world of pharmaceutical patents, and you dropped them in the middle of an internet or computer software case, things would look very different because a lot of the things they take for granted in one industry just aren't true in another industry.
And I think the point we were really getting at in the passages that you highlighted there is that we have a choice. As Mark says, things function differently in different industries based on the innovation profiles of those industries, the cost of developing things and the return that you get and the time and effort that is put in. So what should we do to accommodate the needs of those industries? Should we try and pass a different statute for each one of those? And occasionally we tried to do that in the past. You know, the poster child for this that we talk about in the book a little bit is the Semiconductor Chip Protection Act back from the 1980s when the semiconductor industry said we need a special type of intellectual property protection just for us because we don't think patents or copyrights or anything else is going to do what we need to have done in this industry. Well, Congress did that. They passed that specialized statute for one particular technology. And as it turns out, it's pretty much useless now. It was probably useless as soon as the ink was dry on the president's signature. Why? Well, because the technology has changed. That industry has changed. And so we argue in the book that it's not a good idea to try and pass a different intellectual property statute for software and biotechnology and nanotechnology and synthetic biology and who knows what new innovations are going to happen 5, 10, or 20 years from now. That's not practical. Congress can't do it. You wouldn't want to do that. What you want to have is a single statute that's very flexible, that can be adapted to the needs of these different industries. And that's why Mark says we have nominally a unitary patent system. We have one patent statute. We have one patent office. We even have one appellate court, as we said before, the Federal Circuit, where these cases are reviewed. But we argue that it's flexible enough that you can adapt it to the needs of different industries. Software doesn't need what pharmaceuticals need, but the patent statute can be adapted to cover both.
As you, both Mark and Dan, as you talk about the software industry, and one that we'll return to here, having begun the discussion with Bilski, discussing some of those issues, you know, I'm reminded of the old adage, to paraphrase it, bad facts make bad law. The last several guests that we've had on the show, who I mentioned at the beginning, all more or less think that there's significant problems with software patents. And while you do identify some problems, you don't appear to be as concerned about software patents in and of themselves. Is the software industry a significant outlier based upon the data that you've looked at? You examined a number of industries, and I think you make a persuasive argument saying that these industries really do treat patents differently, and even the lawyering involved is significantly different. Is software a statistical outlier in the sense that we should not base patent law policy on what happens in the software industry?
Well, so here's the problem. The most in patents filed this decade, work that I've done with Bhavin Sampat suggests that half of all applications filed are in the IT industries, broadly defined, so software, but also telecommunications, internet, and so forth. So it doesn't make sense to talk about it as a statistical outlier, in the sense that we can disregard it or treat it separately. Software is a big part of the patent system, but it's not the only part, and it is the case that the characteristics of software are substantially different than the characteristics of other types of inventions in ways that we detail in the book. Now, in terms of whether that means we ought to just try to carve software out from the patent system, I'm inclined to say no. And I think there are a number of problems with trying to do so. The first problem is, if to the extent you believe in the patent system at all, believe in the incentives that patents grant, there are innovative software advances out there, and they cost money, and they are easily replicated. And if there's not some ability to prevent that easy replication, there may be insufficient incentive to invent in certain areas of software. Beyond that, I think we would have a heck of a time trying to figure out what's a software patent and what's not a software patent in order to try to exclude them from patentable subject matter altogether. Past efforts over the last 25 years to do just that essentially ended in abject failure because nobody could draw any meaningful line between the things that they wanted to be patentable and the things they wanted to be excluded from patentability.
I think I'd add a couple of answers to that. First of all, with apologies, I would kind of turn the question around on you. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could ask the same question about biotechnology. People say, well, that's kind of an outlier. Living organisms, they don't seem to fit very well in patent law. Should we have those in patent law? And we could play the same trick with semiconductors. Wow, that's kind of a very different industry. Should that really be part of patent law? Or pharmaceuticals. You mentioned you had Michael Moyer as a guest on the show mm-hmm. a little while ago. The data in his book with Jim Besson seems to indicate that the only place where patent law works really well is in the pharmaceutical chemical area. Well, does that make them an outlier? So part of the argument of our book is you can't really talk about outliers. There's innovation. Innovation happens in different technologies. Each technology has its unique needs and characteristics, and so we have to have a system that will accommodate all of them. The second thing I would say to that is, all advantages are comparative, as our economist friends like to tell us. And so what would be the alternative? If you don't like software in the patent system, where would you go? Well, we tried copyright for a while. Software is still subject to copyright. But as I mentioned before, that was not a very good fit because copyright traditionally applies to things that are literary or artistic. The court struggled for two decades and more to try and make software fit in the copyright ball. box just didn't work very well. I already mentioned a moment ago why we think you don't want to have a separate statute for software. Would you have nothing for software? Well, as Mark just indicated, these innovations can be very expensive, and people expect to be able to recoup their investment. So you need something. What would it be besides patent? Software, as I mentioned a moment ago, is part of an information technology. As our friend Pamela Samuelson likes to say, it's a machine built of text. You know, you usually think of machines being built of metal or plastic or some physical substance. Software is a machine built of text. The patent statute says that it covers things like machines. It covers things that are functional, which software certainly is. And so it seems to be the best fit compared to the other types of intellectual property systems that we're familiar with.
We're talking with Dan Burke and Mark Lemley, co-authors of the book The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to our underwriting department at kzsu.stanford.edu, click on Donate to KZSU, and you will be connected to our underwriting department. You can also email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and you will get a very quick and very happy response to your inquiry. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. Gentlemen, as I read through your book, I was pretty well persuaded by your argument that we don't have one system and that these carve-outs don't work. But I am curious to ask, you talk about in the book, you know, what are currently the most controversial areas of patentable subject matter. Are there any areas or industries, in your estimation, that simply do not require the patent incentive? I mean, I recognize that you don't go as far as David K. Levine and Michele Boldrin do in their book Against Intellectual Monopoly and just say, forget it, we're throwing out the system entirely. Are there any industries that don't need this incentive, or at least don't need the protection of a patent?
Well, so I think the answer is there may well be some, but the process of figuring it out is often a problematic one. You know, if you were to try to draw a line, probably the most defensible one you could try to draw would be one that tried to exclude artistic expression, literary expression, on the grounds that they already got sufficient protection through copyright. So one of the things we've found over the course of the last 20 or 30 years with the development of software and computer graphic animation and that sort of thing is that the line between technological and non-technological creativity turns out to be a really hard one to draw from an invention perspective. So my inclination is to say the right way to think about those questions is not let's pick an industry and exclude it from patentability. It is instead to say let's take seriously the other requirements for patent protection. And if you really require that an invention be novel and non-obvious, and you require that it be fully disclosed so that people can make and use it, most of the things that we're worried about, you know, the development of a new song, the development of a new play or book or script idea, are going to fall out naturally without having to worry about patentable subject matter.
Yeah, and I think rather than trying to identify a particular industry where we say no patents, it's easier to turn to an economic description of the sort of industry that might not need patents, and then we can look and see if any industry fits that profile. So, as we mentioned a moment ago, there are some industries, perhaps, where it's very difficult to replicate or to reproduce the product that's being put out on the market. So that once you develop this innovation and you begin to make it available to the public, your competitors can't quickly reproduce it, and so there's some sort of lag time during which you can recoup your investment. So if you find an industry that looks like that, you might say, well, that's an industry where maybe we don't need patents quite so much. Or if it's an industry where your upfront costs are very low, you know, where there's really not much investment in producing the product, so you don't have that much to recoup once you begin to sell the product, maybe that's an industry where patents at least aren't as important or maybe aren't necessary. And so I would look for industries with those kinds of characteristics to try and identify if there's any place that doesn't really need patents. And part of what Mark is telling you is that things like you know, some sorts of creativity in the literary and artistic area don't seem to need that sort of incentive, right? If you talk to artists, they seem to like to create stuff, and they don't usually involve a lot of equipment to do that, a lot of big upfront investments. So maybe the patents, intellectual property, is important there. But as you begin to move into other areas where there's a lot of investment, you know, a blockbuster Hollywood movie even, or something that requires a lot of equipment or manufacturing investment, intellectual property is going to become more important and patents are going to become more important.
Dan, your last point gets me to something, again, dealing with this issue of not having a unitary patent system, but also your suggestion that we not do carve-outs. Is the analysis or a part of the answer to this question as simple as saying, well, if a particular industry or a particular entity in the industry doesn't need patent protection, they won't apply for a patent, problem solved?
Well, that may be true, except that one of the things that we know, you know, Mark has done a lot of work on this, is that there are all kinds of reasons why you might apply for a patent that have very little to do with the traditional model that we mentioned at the beginning of the program of having some exclusive rights that allow you to recoup your investment. So if you look around at why people are getting patents in software and other areas, sometimes they do it for strategic business reasons. Maybe I don't really need a patent to get my money back, but I'm afraid of what my competitor is going to do, and so you have sort of an arms race, you know, to stockpile patents in case you need them in a dispute. Sometimes people convince venture capitalists or other investors in the biotechnology area, for example, that their product is a good one because they got a patent, and you're more likely to get financing if you have a patent. Some people use it for advertising, right? You can look at various kinds of consumer products, and it'll say patent or patent pending, and people even use that as an advertising point that, you know, my product has been through the U.S. Patent Office, so it must be really innovative, so you ought to buy it. So there are lots of reasons why people might get patents, why they're valuable to different industries, that don't have much to do with recouping their costs, and we have to think about those possibilities as well.
And let me add one other factor, which is Dan has talked about the sort of positive or at least economically neutral reasons one might obtain patents. There are also reasons why people might obtain patents or use patents in ways that hold up an industry, and some of the rules that we have in the patent system right now, I think, do an insufficient job of deterring that kind of litigation abuse. So one of the things you have to worry about is the possibility that people will get patents on an obvious invention, or get patents on a narrow invention and claim that it's a broad invention, and use that claim and the uncertainty associated with it to extort money from companies who are, in fact, making innovative products. I think that's a real problem. I think it's a problem that we need to deal with, and Dan and I spend some time in the book talking about various policy levers that one can use to try to deal with that problem. But I don't think that patentable subject matter eligibility is the right policy lever. It's, Rob Merges once famously said there are three kinds of people in the patent world. There are those who think all patents are bad, and I guess Boldrin and Levine are in that category. There are those who think software patents are bad, and there are those who think bad software patents are bad. And I guess I'm in the last category.
The book is The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. The guests are Dan Burke and Mark Lemley. Mark, you mentioned this phrase policy levers that you use in the book, and it gets us into the third of the 3 points that you articulated in the book that you seek to convince the reader of. So to define this term, what do you mean by policy lever?
Well, what we suggest is that there's a lot of flexibility in the patent statute right now for courts to apply the doctrines of patent law with sensitivity to their policy impact. So I'll give you an example. The question of what happens when a patentee wins their case. What do they get as a remedy? Until 2006, the Federal Circuit essentially said, well, you get an injunction. Always. You get to shut down the defendant's product. The Supreme Court in the eBay versus Merck Exchange case said, that doesn't make any sense. That's not the way we do it in other areas of law. What we should have is a case-by-case inquiry into whether or not you need an injunction, whether or not it would be good for society to grant an injunction. And as a result of that case-by-case inquiry, courts have the ability and seem to be exercising that ability to draw some distinctions between individuals who actually need an injunction, need to shut down a competitor in order to enforce their patent rights, and those who are interested in collecting revenue for the licensing of those rights but don't have any particular claim to be able to shut down the defendant. Now, that's a rule that requires case-by-case application, but it's going to be case-by-case application that's going to work very differently in different industries. So that's an example to us of a policy lever. It's something courts can use within the existing patent framework to distinguish between industries in which there is a substantial problem of holdup or patent abuse and industries in which there isn't, to distinguish between industries in which there are plaintiffs who are non-practicing entities or so-called patent trolls and industries in which there aren't, and to treat those industries differently in ways that hopefully maximize the incentive that the patents provide without doing harm to innovative companies on the defendant side.
Probably the most famous example of a policy lever occurs several times in the patent statute. We talk about this at some length in the book. Different standards for patentability and patent validity that are measured according to the person having ordinary skill in the art, you know, or it's been shortened to FOSITA, P-H-O-S-I-T-A. What does that mean? Well, the statute actually tells the courts, as Mark described to you, when you're looking at a patent and you want to know, for example, is this obvious? You know, is it too obvious to grant a patent on, or is it a non-obvious invention? You measure that according to what the person of ordinary skill in that particular technology would know. And what the person of skill in biotechnology knows is going to, of course, be very different than what the person of skill in software might know. And the result of that policy lever, as we call it, is that what's obvious, the levels that's obvious in biotechnology will be quite different than what's obvious in software, and we think that's appropriate. We think that's one of the tools that a court can use to say, in biotechnology we have one standard and you get a patent under that particular standard. In software we have a different standard because software is different and you get a patent or don't get a patent under the appropriate standard for that technology.
One of the policy levers that you discuss in the portion of the book where you get into the KSR case in your Chapter 9, Policy Levers of Existing Patent Cases, is the issue of the written description requirement. And it's a particular interest of mine, transparency, intellectual property, and we've had several numerous guests on, in fact, who've discussed these issues in different ways with respect to intellectual property. I was familiar with these issues having read the book, but having prior to reading the book, but having read the book, you really brought in the stark contrast the fact that the written description requirement in many industries, including software, seems to be, to use the non-legal phrase, a joke. What is the status of the written description requirement, which of course requires answering what does the written description mean for those who are not familiar, and how strong a policy lever is that, in your view, to correct the problems that we've discussed?
But as we mentioned a moment ago, when we described what patents are, patents involve what lawyers call a quid pro quo or trade between the inventor and the public. The inventor gets 20 years or more or less of exclusive rights in return for disclosing to the public how to make and use the invention. And those disclosure requirements to tell us in the patent, the published patent, how to make and use the invention and show us that you actually had that invention in your possession is a requirement to have a patent and to have a valid patent. And you're right, one of the things we talk about in the book and one of the things that first prompted us to think about this whole area was the fact that the Federal Circuit, this appellate court that looks at patent cases, seem to be treating those disclosure requirements very differently in some industries versus others. In software, they were saying, you know, you don't need to give us a lot of detail about your software invention. Just tell us what it does. You don't need to give us the actual code. You don't need to even give us a flowchart. But just tell us what it does, and then we think that that person of ordinary skill in the art that I talked about, once they know what your invention does, that they can then make it. That it's a trivial matter to write the code to do that. Whereas at the same time in biotechnology, the court was saying, we want a lot of detail. We think that if you're going to get a patent on a DNA sequence or some biotechnology invention, you need to give us the actual sequence of that DNA strand, or you got to give us the actual structure of that protein in great detail. Otherwise, you don't get a patent or you don't have a valid patent. And the implication there is that the person of ordinary skill in software is pretty smart and can figure things out easily on her own, whereas the person of skill in biotechnology needs a lot of help from the patent document. It's kind of stupid because they can't figure it out on their own. We actually think that that's the wrong standard, but we think applied correctly, it is a very powerful tool to get the proper level of disclosure to restrict patents and the scope of patents in areas where developing them is relatively simple, as opposed to areas where developing the invention is very complex.
Gentlemen, we have about 10 minutes left, and I think this brings us to what I know because you address it in the book and something that many listeners may be thinking about, which is, whoa, these authors are suggesting not that the PTO need to be reformed, although it can be reformed, it's not the proper solution, nor should we go to the legislative branch to solve this problem. We need to rely on the courts, and that smacks of the cliched phrase judicial activism. How do you address those that would say that you're relying on the courts and turning the courts into policymakers, and more broadly, that the courts are simply not the place to achieve meaningful patent reform?
Well, let me start with that. I'm not sure there's any content to the phrase judicial activism.
Fair enough.
I disagree with what the court did.
Fair enough.
But if there is any content, judicial activism refers to courts overruling the will of the legislature, striking it down. And that's not something we're suggesting. Congress, of course, has the last word in patent law, and Congress can change it as appropriate. But what we're suggesting is that Congress acts most appropriately not by adopting industry-specific and company-specific and invention-specific rules. We've tried that path in copyright law, and the result was an intellectual property statute that starts to look more and more like the tax code. And we've tried it in patent law in specific areas, and they've all been failures. What we need is a general law, a general statute, but that general statute is necessarily going to have flexibility that gives courts a substantial amount of discretion in applying the rules. So to take just a few examples, the obviousness doctrine in patent law, Congress says you can't have a patent unless the invention is non-obvious, but Congress can't specify what inventions are not obvious for the whole range of possible inventions, it's up to the courts to figure out how to apply that general rule. Congress sets out a general principle defining what constitutes infringement, but it's up to the courts to figure out how to apply that rule in specific factual circumstances. And in making those decisions, which courts are inevitably going to have to do, they could either turn a blind eye to the fact that different inventions and different industries work differently, or they could take account of that information. And we think, given those two choices, it makes perfect sense for courts to take account of the realities of modern patent practice, and those realities are that different industries work differently.
And this shouldn't be a surprising or unusual principle that we've set forward. Congress does this all the time. For example, in the antitrust area, where they've said, in very few words, monopolies and combinations to restrain trade are illegal. Now, courts, you go figure out what's a monopoly. You go figure out what's a restraint of trade, because Congress knew that that would vary by industry, and courts take evidence, and they listen to economists, and they look at the situation, and they make some decision about what constitutes an illegal monopoly or a restraint on trade in a particular industry. We're saying that the same thing ought to happen here. Congress really does this all the time, delegating to the courts the ability to carry out Congress's wishes on a specific industry-by-industry basis. It goes back to what I said earlier about all advantages being comparative. We've got three types of institutions in the American legal system. We've got legislatures, we've got administrative agencies, and we've got courts. And which one should we use? Well, we need an institution that is nimble enough and quick enough to be able to adapt the statute and apply the statute as technology changes over time. We need one that is relatively free of certain types of influences. And when we look among those options, will this be the legislature? Well, no. It takes Congress a long time. It takes years to sort of muster the votes to amend a statute like this. It's unrealistic to think that Congress would be able to update the statute as each new technology arises or as we have changes in technologies. Can an administrative agency do this? Well, they can do a little bit better. But again, there are all types of issues with doing that. The patent office is really designed to look at patents at the beginning of the patent cycle, to assess them and grant patents. The patent office doesn't see all the things that happen when patents are enforced. So they only get part of the picture, and they're not really well adapted to doing that job. The institution that seems to be able to do the best job is the courts. They can take the evidence. They have the tools to do that. Litigation, might take a few years, but it's relatively quick compared to the other types of processes that go on in government. And so are the courts perfect? No, we admit that in the book. But are they much better at doing this than the other options, the legislature and the administrative agencies? Yes, we think they would be.
And we have about 6 or 7 minutes left, gentlemen, 6 minutes. So I'll ask this question as quickly as possible. Is this a high risk move? In other words, there's a high risk, high reward scenario. I litigated for 7 years. I know that if I can, find perhaps even an arcane procedural rule that blocks a case, I might be able to win the case even though the merits of the underlying substantive claim are not on my side. I might be able to, do some forum shopping and find a judge that I think might be more favorable to my client, notwithstanding, again, the underlying substance. I might be able to do forum shopping and find a court that has a particularly bad precedent for my adversary and use that. So are we looking at a situation where, and I'm acknowledging, as you do, that courts are not perfect, that we really run a risk of where we might have wonderful reform, or alternatively, we could have some really bad law come out of the courts if we put this responsibility tacitly on them?
Well, so here's the irony, right, which is what we're proposing is not really reform at all.
Uh-huh.
Right? What we suggest is that courts already have this authority. Courts have already been deciding these cases. And to some extent, right, they are making industry-specific decisions. The problem is that too often they're making industry-specific decisions without thinking about the fact that they're industry-specific decisions. You get a set of written description cases or a set of obviousness cases that look different in biotechnology than they do in software, but it's not because the courts have thought about it and said, oh, the characteristics of this invention are different. You need to disclose more in biotechnology than you need to disclose in software. They're making these industry-specific decisions, in some cases, almost accidentally. So is there a risk that the courts are going to get it wrong? Absolutely. I think the Federal Circuit got it wrong in Bilski, and hopefully the Supreme Court will correct that. But that risk is out there regardless, and we think the risk is a lot less if the courts are actually conscious of the industry characteristics that they're talking about, rather than making these decisions without paying attention to those industry characteristics. And I think that if there are problems, you know, we do have backstops. The Supreme Court can and has stepped in cases like eBay and now Bilski, where it looks like the Federal Circuit has gone astray. And, you know, if and when it's necessary for Congress to step in, you know, we don't oppose the idea of Congress passing law to reform the patent system. What we suggest is that it's courts and not Congress who are best positioned to think about the industry-specific characteristics of that patent system.
The book is The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. The authors are Dan Burke and Mark Lemley. Gentlemen, in our remaining couple of minutes, I'll ask you the closest thing I'll ask to what would be a more typical, perhaps a four-minute interview type radio question. You have the opportunity to implement one of the many policy levers or reforms that you articulate in the book. Which one is the most important to you?
Well, boy, that's a. I think it's a really tough question.
Yep.
Part of the point of the book is there's not a problem with the patent system that can be fixed by a solution.
Mm-hmm.
If I thought that was the case, I'd actually be much less worried about Congress stepping in and fixing the problem, right? If we could point to one thing, one legislative fix that you could do, I'd be okay with that.
Is there one that you would do first?
What the evidence shows is you've got a complex ecosystem in the patent world. And if we're going to get it right, we're going to get it right only by taking account of the industry-specific characteristics and the invention-specific characteristics of the patents before us in deciding whether or not to grant an injunction, in deciding how to calculate appropriate damages, in deciding whether or not a particular invention is obvious. And I think all of those policy levers have to work together to get us to the right outcome. So is there one thing that I think is more out of whack right now than anything else? Mm-hmm. Probably I would say it's the rules for calculating damages. But I don't think there's a single fix that you can point to and say, well, the patent system is broken, but if you just do this one thing, it'll be fine.
I think one of the points we wanted to make in the book, educating policymakers and judges in particular, is that the court really needs a toolbox. There are a whole bunch of possible policy levers that they can use in different circumstances, facing the economics of different industries. Sometimes that might be damages. Sometimes that might be the doctrine of obviousness. Sometimes it might be written description, as we talked about. And the court needs to be aware of all those possibilities and use the right tool for the right industry.
Mark, that you both make fair points, and maybe I could have phrased it differently. Say, which one would I do first? Because I can see it does undermine your argument to say that there's one solution. But I take your point there. Let me ask you this last, radio type question. It's my crystal ball question. Also, probably the most unfair question I can ask. But your educated perception, I'll put it that way, 5 years from now, especially since Bilski has just been granted cert. What's your prediction on where patent law is? Is it in better shape? Is it in worse shape? Or has not much changed?
I'm going to guess it's going to be in better shape, and I think Bilski is an indication of that. As Mark said at the very beginning of the program, the Supreme Court has been more involved over the past few years in correcting course and patent law. Bilski is another intervention by the Supreme Court. I think over the next 5 years in your crystal ball, you would see the Supreme Court continuing to do that, to take some important patent cases and correct course in those places. And so I'm going to guess we're in better shape because of some oversight by the Supreme Court.
I agree with that, and I guess I'll just emphasize one final point. We've been arguing about patent reform in Congress for 5 years now. During that five-year period, the courts have fixed all but one of the major problems that brought patent reform to Congress in 2005. So virtually every issue that was on the table in 2005 is an issue that the courts, often the Supreme Court, but the Federal Circuit as well, have taken care of. The one remaining issue, in my view, where we've really got a problem in the judicial decisions is the patent damages question, but I think it's quite plausible that we will get effective patent reform and a much better patent system, not because Congress steps in and says, here's the magic bullet, but through the accretion of a series of court decisions.
And that really underscores the title of the book. We have a patent crisis, but while Congress has been fighting back and forth for the past 5 years, the courts are beginning to solve it.
The book is The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. The authors are Dan Burke and Mark Lemley. The publisher is University of Chicago Press. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and taking time out of your schedules to educate the listeners. And certainly I invite you back on the show in the near future to continue the discussion and perhaps to discuss Bilski. But thank you today for taking the time.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to a number of great upcoming guests on the show. I encourage you to come and take a look at the Hearsay Culture website, where you can find all of the schedules of upcoming guests and previous shows. Among the people that are going to be on the show within the next couple of weeks are Michael Geist from the University of Ottawa discussing copyright law, as well as Professor John Kunich discussing a variety of works, including his book on leadership based upon the developments and workings of the Chicago Cubs baseball team. An unusual topic for Hearsay Culture, but one that I think you'll find enjoyable. There are also a number of guests coming up in the quarters beginning in July, including Professor Jamie Boyle, Kevin Bankston from EFF, John Turanian from Chapman University School of Law, Michael Heller from Columbia, Siva Vaidyanathan from University of Virginia, Susan Marrett from San Jose State, Kazis Varnalis and Geert Loving, Alex Halliway from Quinnipiac, Professor Gordon Hull from University of North Carolina, Charlotte, as well as Wendy Chun. I thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. As always, you can hear the show by going to hearsayculture.com, by listening live 5 p.m. Pacific times on Wednesday on KZSU-FM Stanford, as well as by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. I hope to hear from you. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com, and otherwise, I encourage you to continue listening to KZSU. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.